This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. We're here ready to discuss the important events of this past week with our panel of trumpet writers. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
And also in the studio, a man you usually have via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
And from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
Is America on course for confronting Iran? Recent developments show that the Trump administration is stepping up its pressure on the Islamic State. And we're going to go through several of these headlines one by one to try to get the whole picture of what's happening here. For this, we're going to turn to Brent. Brent, I'd like you to start by just talking about U.S. activity in southern Syria that appears to be aimed at checking Iran.
Yeah, southeastern Syria is very important right now strategically for the battle against the Islamic State, and then also the looming battle that will take place after the Islamic State is removed from that territory to see who governs it. And what we've seen over the past month, and even we talked about a little bit of this on your Wednesday show, is just this growing situation where Iran is pushing from the Iraqi side of the border to the border, and then from the Syrian side, their different militias are really strengthening their ranks right there to indicate that they want to control this border region. However, what we have in the southeastern portion of that border, just before you get to Jordan, is a really critical United States base. The Al-Tanf base, and that is where they do train a lot of their allies, the United States allies in the fight. You've also got U.S. military servicemen stationed at that base as well. And this base is strategically located as well to put it in the right in that zone that Iran wants to control. So we've seen a number of indicators that Iran is pushing in and around that base to see if the United States is willing to act. And so far, they have been on four separate occasions now. We had the latest coming this past Friday, where the United States blew out of the sky a drone that was flying over this base. And it was an Iranian drone blown out of the sky. And this came after the United States actually blew up an Iranian or Shiite militia convoy as well the week before that was approaching this base. And now what we've seen just this past Thursday is the United States moving its mobile artillery rocket launchers into this base area. This is the first time that these missiles are being deployed onto Syrian in Syrian land. They've got a range of up to 300 kilometers. So the Russians are very upset by this, but it shows that the United States is willing to give an umbrella of protection of at least up to 300 kilometers along this Syrian-Iraqi border to counter what they see as Iran's moves there.
We were talking about just how much Iran's moves are kind of forcing the issue and could well provoke a confrontation. And to this point, it seems like the U.S. does seem to be responding in a more aggressive way, certainly than we have seen in the past.
Certainly it seems that way. And I mean, It came to the point where we saw Iranian-backed militias directly provoke the United States, put in threat, under threat, their own United States troops, and instead of just waving it by, they did act.
In addition to this last week, we just yesterday had quite a widely supported bill passed through the Senate in the United States. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this is a bipartisan bill. 98-2 was the margin in favor. So extremely in an age when they don't seem to agree about much, we had most of the senators voting for this, and that was to impose sanctions both on Russia and also also Iran, and specifically targeting the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is really significant. Because up to this point, the Quds force of the guards was targeted as a terrorist entity, called a terrorist entity by the United States, designated as such. Now the entire IRGC, 100,000 men in the IRGC, an official arm of the Iranian military that reports directly to the Ayatollah, every single one of those members now is, well, that whole group is considered a terrorist entity. So you're basically labeling a nation's military force as a terrorist group. And, I mean, it makes sense, right? Iran's the number one state sponsor of terrorism. You would expect this would have happened before, but it hasn't. And yet we have broad support across the Senate for this. It's still going to be signed by President Trump. Don't see why it wouldn't be. It's still going to go to the House of Representatives. But we still think that this is going to pass. And it is a sign that there is popular support for Mr. Trump to counter what Iran's doing.
And unsurprisingly, an interesting announcement from Rex Tillerson this last week, the Secretary of State, about Iran in the course of a discussion with the press. What did he say?
Right. So he was asked. He was asked about what the official policy of the Trump administration is on Iran, and he said that we are still developing our Iranian policy. It hasn't been. He's of course the Secretary of State, so he helps draw up what the policy would be, and then he puts it forth to the president to see what he thinks about it. And they said that he said that they're going to do that soon. But I'd just like to read you a quote directly from him, because it does have some interesting points. It says, we continually review the merits, both from the standpoint of diplomatic but also international consequences, of designating the IRGC in its entirety as a terrorist organization. So he's talking about that vote that went through. And then he says, as you know, we have designated the Quds Force. And then he said, our policy towards Iran is to push back on this hegemony, contain their ability to develop, obviously, nuclear weapons, and to work towards support of those elements inside of Iran that would lead to a peaceful transition of government. Mm-hmm. So that's a nice way of saying, listen up. If you're in Iran and you do not like the Islamic regime that's currently in control, we're willing to work with you to get rid of that government and have regime change.
Exactly the opposite of what was happening under the Obama administration, where, as Stephen Fleury's been talking about on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, the Obama administration bent over backwards to suppress any kind of support for opposition within the state, and to support the mullahs in Iran. So this is a dramatic change.
Yeah, it's a dramatic shift. And I think there, you know, we do want to make sure that our listeners understand that we're not against Iran when we talk about their actions. There are plenty of people in Iran that aren't happy with the way that their government is going. They're not happy with just the pushing through the Middle East against these other foreign nations. They're not happy with the quest for nuclear weapons. There is a section of the population that is like that. And here is a very vocal statement of support, one that even the Obama administration didn't give when there were protesters out in 2009 on the streets in the Green Revolution in Tehran, standing up, being extremely bold, standing up to a regime, putting their faces out there to say that we don't want you, we want to change, and the United States didn't say a peep. And they took that as a sign that they're not going to have United States support in their goal to get rid of that regime. Well, this president said, basically with this statement, we'll support you if you have the courage enough to stand up.
Interesting to watch, because obviously anybody who's, say, been watching the situation for any time with a level of frustration about America's support for the Iranian regime has to be looking at this and seeing quite a bit to be optimistic about in terms of how this policy may, the ramifications that it may have in terms of what will happen in Iran. Knowing what we know about Bible prophecy, it's interesting just because, as Stephen Fleury has also been bringing out, the United States is not prophesied to have a major impact, that it'll actually be out of the picture by the time something is actually done about Iran. It's impossible to really foresee exactly how this is going to unfold, but it's certainly kind of right in the middle of what we've been talking about, just maybe in a little different direction than what we might expect.
Right, and at least, I mean, there hasn't been concrete large-scale actions against the Iranians yet.
Right.
What we have seen is positioning the United States military to do that, and designating the IRGC as a terrorist group is another move to do that. But when push comes to shove, and we know that the Iranians are going to push, how strong will the United States retaliation really be? The pride in American power has been broken. We expect that to not just be in the Obama administration, but also to follow into this one. So even though it looks positive, what they're doing to Iran, it seems, from a biblical prophecy standpoint, that it will be ineffectual.
We'll keep on watching. We appreciate that, Brent. Another story we've been following is what's happening in South Korea. There, a new president has just come to power who's more pro-China than his predecessor, less friendly to the United States. We've talked about how this could complicate matters for the Trump administration, which is trying to check North Korea's dangerous activities. Certainly, South Korea plays an important role in that effort. Well, it looks like those fears are coming to pass. This is exactly what's happening. For this, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, on Wednesday, the South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, said that he is suspending all further development of the U.S.'s Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, missile system. And this was a pretty big development, mostly because it shows that China is gaining major influence over one of America's most important allies, South Korea. It was actually all the way back in 2014 during the Obama administration that the South Korean military and the U.S. military first agreed to deploy one of America's THAAD systems to South Korea just to protect it from the North Korean threat. And from the very beginning, China was unhappy with this decision because the Korean Peninsula is just right there next to China. And the Chinese leadership worried that the Americans could use the THAAD system to cast their gaze across the Yellow Sea and spy on, you know, Chinese military movements right there on the mainland, and also possibly to undermine China's nuclear deterrent with that system. So for years, China has demanded that South Korea not allow the THAAD system to be deployed. But under South Korea's last president, Park Geun-hye, China's demands were mostly ignored. She was pretty hawkish toward North Korea and not that worried about trying to please China. So the U.S. took all kinds of steps during her presidency to get the THAAD system going. And President Park ended up being impeached and then ousted from office earlier this year for a big corruption scandal. But enough groundwork had been laid so that the U.S. was still able to go ahead and bring THAAD online in April. It was only a partial deployment, but it was enough to protect South Korea and Japan and the U.S. military assets in both of those countries from a large part of the North Korean threat. And then the plan was to keep on building the THAAD system up throughout this year so that it would be fully operational by the end of 2017. By then, President Moon was elected last month. On May 9th, he came to power, and he replaced President Park and said that he wants to have expanded engagement toward North Korea. He's taken a much more conciliatory tone toward China. And he seems to possibly even think that South Korea has a better chance of working with China to contain the North Korean threat than it does with working with America to contain that threat. So now he said, we're not going to allow the rest of this THAAD system to be brought online. So it's a pretty serious development there, I think.
It seemed for a little bit that China was actually beginning to soften and take a little bit more of a hard stance against North Korea. It seems like with South Korea making this move, that would shift the leverage in China's favor.
Yes. Yeah, I believe it does. China has cut off all of their coal imports from North Korea, which was one of North Korea's main economic lifelines. But we've seen them boost imports of some other minerals and iron ore and things like that. And I think with this development, with South Korea really becoming a lot more conciliatory toward China, you're exactly right. That does reduce America's leverage on China. And I think we can expect China to maybe not apply the pressure that the Trump administration was hoping Beijing would apply on the North.
Well, thanks for bringing us up to speed with what's happening there, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. A big story this week out of Britain. The leader of the Liberal Democrat Party has resigned, and for a very compelling reason. He says he realized it's impossible to uphold his party's increasingly progressive political platform and remain true to his religious views as a Christian. We've been talking about this on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show this week. Wednesday, Richard wrote about it in his Trumpet Brief. This is an email briefing we send out each day. I certainly recommend you sign up for that if you don't have it. But we're going to get caught up to speed on this story by going straight to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
That's right. So Tim Farron is the individual in question. The Liberal Democrats are historically the third party in Britain's parliamentary system. With all the political upheaval, that's kind of changed a bit in recent years. But still, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, it's a major party. They were in a coalition with the Conservative Party recently. The leader of the Liberal Democrats was Britain's deputy prime minister. And so after the election, Tim Farron gave a speech and he said, well, like I said, I need to step down because I can't be a religious person and lead this party. And then he said, well, if we think we live in a liberal, tolerant society, well, no, that's not true. And he's absolutely right.
Right. Yeah, that really is quite an extraordinary statement. You brought out the fact that really, so many of his views, he has actually moved in the direction of his party, that he's actually caved in on abortion and some other things that you would look at and say, well, he's taking a more liberal social position in these areas, and yet still he's not moving fast enough for his party and for Britain more generally.
That's right. I mean, that's the thing that really stood out for me from this. I mean, he voted in favor of homosexual marriage.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he's ever voted against that or campaigned against that. If anything, he was kind of, you know, some of the ones pushing for homosexual marriage. So it's not like, say, he's one of these. He's not at all comparable to, say, a Republican in the United States that is there trying to get homosexual marriage overturned or doing this or that. He has.
Do we still have any of those? I'm actually trying to. We've moved pretty far, but definitely Britain is moving faster.
But yeah, he's not. So in terms of what people object to, they can't point to a single thing that he's done to say, we object to you doing that. We object to you because you voted this way or that way. Nothing like that at all. It's entirely based on what he thinks. And the objection is, well, you can't even think that way and be a leader of a major political party. So, for example, he was asked, well, you know, do you believe that homosexual activities, is that a sin? And he tried to answer that by basically saying, well, it doesn't matter what I think. You know, look at my voting record. I've always voted in favor of homosexual rights and homosexual marriage. I have my own views, but I believe everybody should be allowed to live as they want. And he got absolutely hounded for that. And eventually he came out and put out a statement saying, no, I don't believe that it's a sin, several days later. But even with that kind of...
Too late, damage was already done.
Right, but even... I think it's just the fact that he wouldn't come out and say that immediately, right away.
Yeah.
You know, people objected to that. And so when you can't be even as mild of a Christian in terms of how much you let that affect your politics as Tim Farron... That shows the state of Britain. And then you contrast that to the leader of the Labour Party right now,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, literally went to spoke at a rally for an extremist group that was outlawed later as a terrorist group. And then members from this extremist group went out and carried out a terrorist attack on the streets of London in the run-up to the very election that he was standing in. You know, you can do that and you can get a standing ovation from your party. That's mainstream. That's fine. But being a little bit hesitant when it comes to endorsing homosexuality is beyond the pale. It shows just the extreme topsy-turvy world of British politics today.
Right. And just going back to his statement about just the fact that if we think that we are actually a liberal, tolerant society, we're kidding ourselves. And that really is... quite an extraordinary statement that it is, as you said, it's not the voting record. It is, are you thinking in an orthodox way according to the liberal orthodoxy? If you're not, we have no use for you. And to consider the pressure that he was under and the way that he came out and expressed his frustration and this sort of pickle that he was in, I think he really did he did us all quite a service by vocalizing this the way that he did, because he's given a voice to this trend that we've seen in Britain, in America, that is it's really just drawing attention to reality in a way that we haven't heard before. Andrew, you had a comment.
Yeah, we actually saw something maybe not quite that bad, but similar to that in the United States, I think last week, where President Trump had nominated someone as for like a deputy budget director position, and his opponents had looked up his record and found that he'd written a internet post some time ago saying that the Muslims stand condemned because they haven't accepted Jesus. And the post was very clear that he's not advocating discrimination against Muslims in any sort of way. He's just saying that in his Christian religious denomination, he didn't believe that you'd gain salvation until you'd accepted Christianity. Mm-hmm. And during his confirmation hearing, actually, Senator Bernie Sanders had said that that view disqualified him from office. He may still get appointed just because the Republicans have the majority, but it was just a bit of kind of like a media kerfuffle over that, is that just the double standard is, first of all, there are many Muslim denominations that believe you're not going to see Allah unless you convert. But yet he's fine with them running for office. But he's basically saying that anyone who belongs to a Christian denomination that believes you have to convert to Christianity to be saved is not fit for office in the United States of America.
It's amazing just how quickly things change. Things that were normal, that most people would agree with less than a generation ago. Like that, I mean, that's a fairly standard Christian view that that guy articulated, and they're getting hounded for it so quickly. And it's the same with all of these. I mean, homosexual marriage, it was, what, 4 or 5 years ago that it was legalized. There were attempts even in Britain to legalize it before then that were thwarted. But, I mean, Tim Fallon is right in that you see this throughout society. And I think it's interesting that double standard is interesting as well. The big example of this to me is there was a scandal a few years back. It's kind of known as the Trojan Horse scandal, where there were a bunch of schools that were teaching radical Islam inside these Muslim-controlled schools. And the government, after that all came out and there was a big outcry, the government kind of said, okay, well, we have to stop this. They passed some laws. And since then, these laws have only ever been applied against Christian schools teaching creation.
Wow.
And they've right. And that the laws specifically designed to stop extremism in schools, and they've never been used to stop Islamist extremism. The kind of liberal society and elites got a hold of them and turned them against turned them against Christians. So this double standard and hostility there specifically against Christianity is just becoming clearer and clearer.
Stunning, stunning development. We appreciate that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We're going to go now to American politics, a gut-wrenching story in the nation's capital. On Wednesday, a gunman opened fire on members of the Republican congressional baseball team. He wounded 4 people, including Republican Representative Steve Scalise, before being killed. It really seemed to confirm concerns over just how polarized and ugly and violent the political landscape in America is becoming. For this, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. Well, yeah, just to guess in recap, I mean, a lot of our listeners may have been aware of this story, but it was 7 a.m. Wednesday morning when James Hodkinson walked up to the Republican national baseball team, asked someone at the sidelines. He's like, says, is this a Republican team or a Democratic team? And he said, so it's a Republican team. He's like, okay, well, I'll be right back. And he came back with a gun. And like I said, shot a congressman, a lobbyist, an aide, and a security guard before one of the other security guards shot and killed the shooter. And so actually it was fairly fortuitous that, in a way, that because this was a congressional baseball team, there were actually armed security guards there who were able to stop this guy from killing more people. But it was also known that when they looked into the investigation, they found out that this man was a Democratic activist for the Bernie Sanders campaign during the last election, and had recently put up a Facebook post about how Donald Trump is a threat to American democracy and he has to be stopped by any means possible, which viewed in isolation, this would just look like maybe this is just some crazy guy who decided he wants to go shoot up a bunch of baseball players. But viewed in the bigger scheme, there is obviously this does seem to be like a trend of like political violence, especially coming from the left-wing political parties in America. Mm-hmm. Newt Gingrich had mentioned that too. They said just a couple weeks ago you had the Kathy Griffith scandal where she had the decapitated replica of Trump's head covered in blood. And there was also in New York, there was a Shakespeare in the Park play with of Julius Caesar, but Julius Caesar had on the Trump wig. And then they had a picture of him out there laying there covered in blood. And then, of course, you've had the down in like Florida, you had the universities giving the Punta Nazi, I guess, quote unquote, self-defense training, where they're actually training people how to throw punches at conservatives at political rallies. And then like every other week, Berkeley goes up in some sort of like left-wing riot. So this is just a lot of different examples of either left-wing protesters committing acts of political violence or left-wing comedians or Shakespearean actors putting up images of the president as a dictator who needs to be killed. And then you act shocked when someone actually does go and shoot somebody.
Mm-hmm. Right. We were talking about the double standard applied in Britain when you're talking about tolerance and so on. We can tolerate Islamic extremists in our midst, but we cannot tolerate somebody who may harbor a view of homosexuality that would be based in the Bible. Here you have this double standard with if any of these things had been perpetrated under Barack Obama, if you had had a Shakespearean troupe depict the assassination of a president who looked like Barack Obama, there would have been quite an outcry. I think there were some few who had like lynchings of Barack Obama effigies and that type of thing. That there are crazy people out there, but it seems like this has become more front and center in a lot of ways, and it does. In some ways, it was a relief that we made it through 8 years without an assassination of the president, as crazy as some people may be. But you just wonder how much longer is it going to last?
Right. And definitely, I do remember seeing some of those like effigies of Barack Obama coming from the other side of the political spectrum, although they were definitely much less prominent people.
Right.
Doing those. These weren't like A-lister comedians and Shakespearean actors and people with a ton of media publicity. It was normally just some like crazy guy that without many political connections. But it is, National Interest kind of has a piece here almost comparing it to a little bit tongue in cheek, but to like Weimar Germany, where you just had the political system was so broken that instead of actually having debates or political, you just had like riots and street thugs and duking out in the streets. And of course, in Weimar Germany, it was mostly like fascist against communist, with violence coming from both sides. In America, it does seem to be quite a bit more one-sided. We haven't seen any conservative college students flipping over cars and burning. Burning buildings and or getting on television with trying to express some sort of like artistic way of murdering the president.
Right.
But you just get this type of venomous political discourse where you don't want to discuss things. You don't want to argue the points. You want to shut down. You can't win the argument, so you want to shut it down and scare people from even bringing it up in the first point. And sometimes they even purposely encourage to shut down discussion. But when you start throwing out that sort of venomous rhetoric, whether you intend it or not, it does spiral out of control. And you see things like this baseball shooting happening.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We'll take a short break. Coming up, we're going to talk about a massive Russian military exercise about to take place right on the border of NATO, a Russian airstrike in Syria that may have hit a very sensitive target, a stunning development in Spain's economy, and how the Chinese Communist Party has burrowed deep into Australia's political system. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
In America, we've been hearing a lot of fear-mongering about Russia in recent months. But in some parts of the world, it's not just rumors of Russian computer hacking or meddling that people have to be concerned about. It's Russian troops. The Baltic states in Northern Europe are getting nervous as Russia mounts a giant military exercise right on its border, 100,000 troops involved. For this story, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yep, Russia and its ally Belarus are gearing up for just some really massive joint war games. The name of the drill is Zapad 17, and it's scheduled to happen in September of this year. And for this drill, they'll end up having about 100,000 troops right on NATO's border. The purpose of the Zapad drill is to prepare Russian and Belarusian troops just to be able to repel a potential invasion of Belarus by NATO forces. The Russian word Zapad just means west, and so this is a drill that simulates a full-scale conflict between Russia and the West. And the NATO nations that neighbor the location of these war games are very nervous about such a huge buildup of Russian troops on their borders. These troops will be mostly in Belarus, which borders Poland, Lithuania, and Latvia, all three of which are NATO countries. And then Estonia is another NATO nation that will be just across the border from the Russian part of these war games. Lithuania's Minister of Defense, Raimundas Karoblis, said, quote, "It's not comfortable at all when we expect to have 100,000 troops on our borders." And then Estonia's defense minister, Margus Tsahkna, said that many Estonians are really worried about just the lack of transparency in these war games. He wonders if it's really just a training exercise or possibly preparations for something more sinister. Mr. Tsahkna and several other Baltic officials have warned that Russia may end up leaving a lot of these troops in Belarus after the exercises are over.
Which would be based on past experience and what's happened in Ukraine and other areas where that's exactly what Russia has done.
That's right, yes. There's plenty of reason to be very concerned about the lack of transparency and just what Russia's true motives really are. And then this was 2 weeks ago, U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis visited Lithuania, and he said that even if Russia doesn't use this massive drill as a pretext, you know, to take some other kind of action, just having such a huge troop buildup next to NATO territory is, quote, simply destabilizing. Mm-hmm. So he's very concerned about it. And then I've got one more quote here from Mr. Karoblis. He said, "We need to be prepared for surprises. Russia could go to a different direction than planned. And there's also a chance that there could be some tests of how the border protection is working." So it's causing a lot of fear in the Baltic nations and beyond. And this Russian war game really fits into the broader picture of just kind of disruptive Russian activities. We've seen the Russians continuing to foment conflict there in eastern Ukraine, which you mentioned. We've seen them buzzing military ships owned by the U.S. and NATO. We've seen them waging all kinds of disinformation campaigns and just doing anything they can to destabilize Western nations. So it's an alarming trend.
And I just can't help but to think back to the comment that you've brought up before, where Russia has a tendency to swallow up a little bit of territory and then sit back and wait wait for everybody to become somewhat complacent and comfortable with the new normal. Then it takes another step forward. And it does seem like in some ways Russia has been a little quiet in recent months in terms of territory. There have been things that it's done that have been provocative to some degree, but you just wonder if it feels like maybe the time is ripe to make another move.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Some analysts compare it to China's moves in the South China Sea, which have sometimes been called salami slicing, where you just take enough, you take only enough actions not to prompt any major response from the U.S. or other countries. It's all, you know, calculated very carefully and done gradually enough to not appear to be as threatening as it is over the long haul.
Well, we'll talk about another Russian story now. It's been quite heavily involved in Syria, and reports emerged this week that one of its airstrikes there may have hit a quite important target. For this, we're going to go to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so just today we had reports from the Russian Defense Ministry that back on May 28th, the Russian Air Force struck a pretty large meeting of Islamic State individuals in their capital in Syria, in Raqqa. About 30 commandos were killed, 300 soldiers, so it's a substantial airstrike. But they did release one possible fact in that the head of the Islamic State, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, he may have been killed in this airstrike as well. The Russian foreign ministry came out and said, or Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, he said that he's obviously seen these reports. He doesn't have 100% confirmation on this. The Americans say this might have happened. We're not entirely sure just yet. But obviously releasing such a potential non-story by the Russian government has repercussions, especially for its fight in Syria. Whether or not he's actually dead, we can see this affecting the optics of their offensive there. Of course, they came into the Syrian civil war claiming that they were fighting against the Islamic State. When they got there, they didn't fight against the Islamic State. They supported the Assad regime. If they can see after 2 years in, or if they can claim after 2 years in that, no, actually, we were fighting the Islamic State, and in fact, we knocked off the top guy, that could look very good and even change the narrative of Russia's intervention there in Syria. It would also be good for them to release this just because the Islamic State is so much on the back foot right now through communications that have been made public. Haven't seen Baghdadi since November of last year. Hmm. So where's he been for the past 6 months? He's been in hiding, obviously, not to reveal his position. Well, it might be now that since you haven't seen me in 6 months and he may be killed, we might see the Islamic State fracture even further.
Jeremiah, you had a comment.
Yes, I just thought it was interesting that this comes just as mass protests are taking place in towns and cities across Russia. There's just quite a bit of domestic unrest. These are anti-corruption protests. The young people in Russia especially are not nearly as enamored of President Putin as their parents are. And it just seems like the timing of this, we've seen these sorts of moves before just as a bit of a distraction. Don't worry about what's happening here, our faltering economy. Take a look at this victory, this military victory outside of the country that we've just had. So I just wondered if that could have been part of the motivation for the timing.
Well, thanks for that, both of you gentlemen. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program. We have seen quite a stunning development in Spain. This month, Spain's sixth largest bank was sold for the fire sale price of €1. For this story, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, it's your every few monthly reminder that Europe's financial problems aren't solved and things are very messy there. And it's still it's only a matter of time before something comes up that that just causes yet another outbreak of the crisis there. So the latest comes from Banco Popular, Spain's sixth largest bank, and they had to be sold to Santander for $1. It's €1. It's one of those things where one bank collapses and everybody starts looking nervously around. Is this the Lehman's moment? Are there more banks that are going to come down? People start getting worried about other banks that are very restless. So attention has now come on to a number of other banks. Liber Bank, they lost a huge chunk of their share price in the wake of that. The government had to step in and ban short selling. Short selling, it's essentially a way of betting that the share price is going to go down. It also pushes the share price down. So when the government steps in and stops short selling, it's because lots of people are afraid that the bank is going to collapse, and the government wants to kind of stop that from becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. things seem to have stabilized a little at Liberbank, but there are still some economists saying that it's heading for trouble down the road. Unicaja is another bank. It saw the value of its bonds plummeted by 15%. And then you're in Italy. There's the popular Di Venezia and the Veneto Banca that are also both in a very bad position. The Italian government's currently negotiating with the European Central Bank to try and figure out what to do about these problem banks. Negotiations have continually failed. And I think it's towards the end of this month that they're kind of about to reach the end of the road on those negotiations. So it just shows a lot of the uncertainty around Europe's banking system. The other interesting thing about this bailout of the Banco Popular is it was the first test for Europe's new banking rules. And these banking rules mean that people who wouldn't have lost money before in previous bailouts are now having to lose money. And so the repercussions from that are going to be very interesting to watch, because while it's very easy to understand the sentiment behind that, you know, why should the taxpayer be on the hook for bailing out private banks? And I think that's absolutely a fair point. But the effect that it has is, as soon as people start to ask questions about a bank, it just adds to the incentive, no matter who you are, to get your money out of that bank.
Right.
Whereas if you know that your money is going to be protected, even if it does go bust, you're going to be in a less of a hurry to do that. Now, these rules weren't applied to the complete extent that they could be, but it was the first time ever in Europe that a certain category of bondholder has lost money. And so, again, that's the other reason why people are kind of anxiously looking around now at the health of other banks, because, you know, these rules, they've been there, but now they've been put into practice. And so they're worried about how people could respond in other banks now.
So seeing this happen to Spain's sixth largest bank, can you just put this in perspective for us in terms of what this means for Spain's economy and just other European economies that are basically in the same boat as what we're seeing with Spain? How much pressure does this put on the European economic zone in general?
Well, it's probably just now the focus turning to Italy and seeing what happens with those negotiations. I think in terms of the size of the bank, it's not a Deutsche Bank-sized bank. Mm-hmm. It's not Santander, even the big Spanish bank. So it's not the kind of bank that's systemically important in that its collapse is going to have all of these major ramifications. The big risk here comes from people's confidence in other banks that are in similar situations. And if the bailout causes people to lose confidence in these other banks, then we have a big problem. If they don't, which actually at the moment it looks like, then the fallout is probably going to be fairly limited. So I think that's where we start. It's about confidence in Europe's banking systems, and it's about a reminder that banks are still going down. And there are certainly other banks, and there are certainly bigger banks in Banco Popular's situation that don't have, say, immediate problems, but they certainly have long-term problems that are nowhere near fixing, like Deutsche Bank, a huge, absolutely huge bank that has huge problems. And so it's when one of these big banks that gets into trouble will probably have real, real problems with Europe.
Yep. Well, we appreciate that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We'll finish with an investigation in Australia that was broadcast earlier this month that uncovered just how the Chinese Communist Party has infiltrated the Australian political system, how Chinese billionaire businessmen are operating in Australia, and it's really compromised Australia's political integrity, having these massive Chinese political donations. For this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. We actually have an article up on thetrumpet.com right now by Callum Wood outlining a lot of the details of this story, but it is quite groundbreaking as to just how much the Communist Party of China is donating to Australian political parties and business leaders. Somewhat surprisingly, that's not actually illegal. There's not limits on how much money the Communist Party can donate. And they've definitely taken advantage of that. He talks about one wealthy Chinese property developer who was given $20 million to construct a university in Sydney, $200,000 to a state branch of the Labour Party, $560,000 to the Liberal Party, and actually even $4 million to other major parties. And this is just one particular Chinese businessman who's a member of the Communist Party and sits on several influential committees within the Communist Party. And so, like I said, it's not necessarily illegal, but it is definitely a huge national security factor nonetheless, just because of the some of the strings that could be attached. He points out actually later in the article about one politician who'd given who actually promised to give the Australian Labor Party a $400,000 donation. And then shortly after that promise was made, the Australian Labor Party really took a much more hardline stance against Chinese expansion into the South China Sea. And he decided to not donate the $400,000. So it wasn't necessarily an overt back off on the South China Sea or we're not going to fund you, but it was definitely much more of a passive aggressive, like, hey, look at all this money I'll give you. Like, oh, yeah, that South China Sea thing. He's like, well, I've been looking at my financial statements and decided that I guess we can't afford to give you that money after all. So though it's definitely well understood that if you want the money, play nice with China.
Right. Yeah, China is really quite a shrewd operator, and it does seem to it has a lot of cash surplus, and it does seem pretty intent on leveraging that in order to gain influence and resources and power in far-flung places. And Australia really isn't putting up any kind of fight at all against this kind of incursion of influence in its own country.
No, this is something that China's definitely done around the world. Just a couple of years ago, I think they've bought out most of the farms in Zimbabwe that white farmers used to farm until Mugabe kicked them out, and then the Chinese bought them. And they're like the new colonial overlords in that country. And then they've done this in nations around the world, even here in the United States, although we definitely have some more laws that limit the amount of purchasing that you can sell to foreign governments. But Australia is definitely one really notable example that I don't know if it's economic pressure or just need for money or what it is, but they really haven't had much laws or oversight into this type of thing at all, which is, as this report brings out, is definitely a concern with all these like universities, businesses, political parties accepting all this money from the Communist Party of China to the point of even becoming dependent upon some of this money from the Communist Party of China. And now if they make any decisions that upset the Communist Party of China, you're putting all that funding that you've become so used to at risk.
The article appears on thetrumpet.com, Australian Politicians Accepting Chinese Money, by Trumpet writer Callum Wood. Go check it out. Along with all of the other stories that we've been talking about, we really do make a strong effort to get all of that up onto the website for more context and links to articles in the archives that put it in greater context with biblical prophecy. We appreciate that you bringing that to us, Andrew. Visit us on thetrumpet.com, and you can subscribe to The Trumpet Brief, our daily email that we send out each day. One of the Trumpet writers, a personal message to our readers and our listeners. Really an excellent resource for you to draw on. We're going to finish the program up next with our lightning round of important news. That's coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We'll finish with our lightning round. One last look at some headlines that caught our attention from this past week, and we'll start with Richard.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel kicked off a G20 summit on Africa on Monday. She was promoting much closer economic ties between Europe and Africa. And interestingly, she raised the prospect of more arms sales to Africa. She said, well, for years we felt good not selling military equipment to Africa. But she said, we have to be honest, only when security is ensured can development take place. So we could see Germany now playing a much more direct role in kind of arming African states against militant groups and especially Islamic militant groups.
All right, over to Brent.
Yemen's Iran-backed Houthi rebels claimed another attack on a Saudi coalition vessel, a warship in the Red Sea, on Wednesday. This attack took place off the coast of the Yemeni city of Mocha, about 60 miles north of the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. It was a UAE vessel reportedly carrying medical supplies. The Houthis were the ones that actually posted video of the attack, broadcasting this grainy video with a fireball that was approaching the ship and then the ship bursting into flames. And these attacks seem to be coming thick and fast now, with them happening almost weekly.
All right, over to Jeremiah.
On Tuesday, Taiwan lost one of its precious few allies. Most countries have to choose whether to have close diplomatic ties with China or with Taiwan. China doesn't really allow both in most cases. And up until Tuesday, Panama had been among the 20 or so countries that chose Taiwan over China. But then the Panamanian government came out and said there is only one China and Taiwan is part of it. So basically, Panama caved to China and said Taiwan is not even a sovereign country. So it's another big blow to the independence of a small nation that's trying to keep free from the control of China.
And back to Richard.
Grenfell Tower burnt down in London this week. It looks like a major tragedy. Around 70 residents of that tower reported missing, so the death toll could be that high. They still haven't figured out exactly how high it is, but it also could have a major impact on British politics. It really ties into this narrative that Jeremy Corbyn and the left have been pushing about the have-nots and the poor being victimized by greedy companies that don't pay attention to fire safety. And he's even calling for vacant properties owned by the rich to kind of be confiscated, to be given to people who lost their homes in the tower disaster.
And Andrew.
The United States Army officially began compulsory transgender sensitivity training this week. The Army began sessions on Tuesday, which was compulsory for all officers, non-commissioned officers, and civilians who work with soldiers. The goal of the program is to help implement Army policy on transgender recruitment and to assist, quote-unquote, soldiers going through gender reassignment surgery. The training sessions spring from a decision by a former Defense Secretary Ash Carter, but have been ordered by current Defense Secretary James Mattis to begin without delay.
All right, and back over to Brent.
Archaeologists have uncovered a king-size mikveh in the ruins of Mekaris. That's in Jordan, that overlooks the Dead Sea, a fortress built 2,000 years ago by the Roman, or vassal Roman king Herod. He's the one that was alive during Jesus Christ's birth. This mikveh ritual bath and immersion pool is used for purification and was apparently built for the Herod royal family themselves. It's the biggest bath of its kind that's ever been found in Jordan. It boasts over 12 steps and a reserve pool for filling up the mikveh when needed. They should have done a little bit more purifying over there, because this was also the location that John the Baptist was sent to prison and then was later beheaded by Herod the Great's son, Herod Antipas.
Back to Richard.
Another German politician making headlines this week was Defense Minister Ursula von der Leyen. She said on Saturday that Germany and France are working together on some specific proposals on how to use money from a pan-European defense force. She said that Germany and France want to become the motor of a European defense union and implement the defense fund in a smart way, and added that the Brexit referendum and the US election opened our eyes. Europe must take more responsibility for our own security.
And now to Jeremiah.
Nothing short of war will prompt North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons. That's the assessment of a new and very compelling article by The Washington Post's Andrei Lenkov. He says that the Trump administration's assumption that if China applies more pressure to the North, then the North will give up its nukes is dangerously misguided. North Korea sees nuclear weapons as the only guarantee of the regime's survival. So Mr. Lenkov says that it's increasingly clear that the only thing that would rid the Korean Peninsula of nuclear weapons is the force of war.
Back to Andrew.
The recent spat of murders attributed to the MS-13 street gang in Long Island, New York, are not an accident. Rather, they're the result of a specific directive from higher-ups in El Salvador. According to U.S. law enforcement officials, drug cartel leaders in El Salvador have implemented a New York program which mandates increased violence and bloodshed in New York State to increase the gang's presence. The MS-13 street gang has been linked to a startling 38% of all homicides in Long Island over the past 16 months.
We'll finish with Richard.
Angela Merkel was last weekend traveling through Latin America. She was hailed as the most important politician in the world by leaders desperate for an alternative to Donald Trump's America. And while on that trip, she said she was trying to speed up negotiations on an EU-Mercosur, that's the South American trade bloc, speed up negotiations between the two. And if that was successful, it would create a trade bloc that contained almost 1 billion people.
Well, thank you for that, gentlemen. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Give us your feedback by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to these gentlemen, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
No problem.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks also to Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan, our staff. I'll leave you with the words of John Ruskin. It is a good and safe rule to sojourn in every place as if you meant to spend your life there, never omitting an opportunity of doing a kindness or speaking a kind word or making a friend. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.